I'm Angie Coiro. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Rose Aguilar is on vacation today. What happens to small towns in Sasha Abramski's new book, Chaos Comes Calling, The Battle Against the Far-Right Takeover of Small Town America? Well, listen to this. Right-wing vigilantes wearing orange vests and voter task force badges could be found banging on doors in Shasta County, asking residents about their voting history in a nefarious attempt to root out supposedly rampant election fraud, presumably among the one-third of the electorate who didn't cast their votes for Donald Trump when presented with the opportunity to do so. Armed men and women even forced their way into the electoral count during the primaries on the night of June 7, 2022, as observers. Unfortunately, that is not from a dystopic novel. It really happened, as recounted in Abramski's new book, Chaos Comes Calling, The Battle Against the Far-Right Takeover of Small Town America. The book documents one such event after another in Sequim, Washington, and Shasta County, California. As noted in Kirkus Reviews, even though progressives do play a part in the fights over voting, January 6th and school curricula, quote, those wars are being fought between right-wingers and farther right-wingers, complete with litmus tests of ideological purity. My guest, Sasha Abramski, is the nation's Western correspondent. He's the author of several books, including The American Way of Poverty, The House of 20,000 Books, Little Wonder, the fabulous star of Lottie Dodd, the world's first female sports superstar, and most recently, this new book. Sasha, welcome back.
Angie, it's good to be on the show. Thanks for having me on.
I'm glad to have you. Well, authors and documentarians have focused on American red zones in the past, and they, you see that too in the newspapers. You know, we went to a small town diner and talked to so-and-so. And the effort, of course, is trying to decipher how prejudice and fear and violence have taken over. Tell me what hole you saw in that coverage. What was lacking that sent you on your own investigation of small red towns?
I think one of the things that's happened over the last several years is, in a sense, the media market's fragmented, so that people who live in big cities tend to read about big cities, and people who live in small towns, increasingly, they feel that they're sort of disempowered, that they're outside the mainstream media ecosystem. And what I wanted to do was immersion reporting. I didn't want to just go in for a few hours and talk to one or two people. I wanted to go in again and again and again and talk to lots of people and try to talk to those people several times to really get a sense of what was going on inside their head, to really get a sense of the political climate that was involved, that was evolving in the two towns that I was focusing on. So one was Shasta County, and especially the town of Redding, and the other was Clallam County in the Washington Peninsula, Olympic Peninsula, and the town of Sequim. And my intent was to say, all right, here are these sort of political schisms that have emerged. How does that play out on the ground? What does it mean when neighbor turns against neighbor? What does it mean when community turns in on itself and starts regarding public health officials not just as someone to have maybe an intellectual disagreement with over, you know, lockdown measures or school closures, but as a mortal enemy? What does it mean to have a politician you regard not just as somebody you disagree with, but again, as a traitor, as somebody who's treasonous to the basic idea of America? And that was what was happening in these communities. And I think it was happening in a lot of communities around the country over the last several years. So my intent in writing Chaos Comes Calling was to tell a much larger story, in a sense, a story of America in the 2010s and the 2020s, and a story of what was happening to this country and to its democratic premise.
You know, one question that always comes up in scenarios like this is, did Donald Trump and the far right, did they inflame fractures that were already in place, or did they create truly new dissonance?
You know, that's a great question. And one way to look at it is Trump a cause or is he a consequence?
Yes.
And the answer is yes, he's a cause, but he's also a consequence. He's a cause of the divisions because the more he demagogues, the more he talks about immigrants in the way he does, the more he talks about the media as the enemy of the people, the more he sort of makes these outlandish claims about creating televised military tribunals for enemies and so on, the more he inflames things locally. But how can someone like Donald Trump emerge? How is that conceivable that a man of Trump's amoral character could acquire the kind of potent political power that he has? And the answer is, well, social media, the internet, the spread of a sort of very debased rumor mill based form of news. So he's both cause and he's consequence. And the same thing holds on the ground. The reason so many people support Trump is because of all these fractures and all of this disinformation that's out there. But once someone like Trump's in power, it further inflames all of the divisions that are already there in a place like Shasta County.
Do you see the far right that is in power, and specifically, I mean, those in office and those who have a great deal of money, are they puppet masters who are pulling the strings in situations like this, or are they more organic to the towns themselves?
Yeah, I don't think they're puppet masters. I think there is something organic about this right-wing movement. It does, in some ways, sort of percolate from the ground up, but it also trickles down from the top. So it's, you know, coming back to the answer I said previously, there are plenty of local street orators and plenty of local activists in a place like Shasta County that in and of themselves are capable of swinging the political climate rightward in that region, especially during the pandemic era when people were so fearful and there was so much dislocation and there was so much uncertainty about whether the lockdowns were the right thing to do, whether school closures were the right thing to do, whether public health officials had a right to impose masks and then vaccine mandates and so on. So I think all of that was coming from the ground up. But again, it gets magnified when you have someone like Donald Trump in the White House and he's sending out tweets saying, liberate Michigan, liberate Virginia. And he starts going off on this tear against Democratic controlled states and their public health measures. When you start having a president who gives a nod and a wink to groups like the Proud Boys, which are basically street fighters with a sort of fascist veneer. When you have that kind of messaging coming from the top down, it coarsens the debate locally, and it gives people an excuse to unleash their worst instincts. So you have this sort of complete collapse of civility, especially online. You look at social media, you look at email, you look at the kinds of messages that are being sent to political figures, being sent to public health officials in the period 2020, 2021, and so on. And you see an absolute breakdown of just basic norms of civil communication. And their replacement with death threats, with just endless bullying, endless intimidation. Now, again, not all of that can be blamed on Donald Trump, or not all of it can be blamed on hard right activists and media warriors like Alex Jones and Steve Bannon. But a lot of it can, because they coarsened the debate and they gave permission to their followers to go down this really, really dark path rhetorically.
We meet a number of interesting people in the book, and two of them that really stood out to me, there's a nurse who ends up terrified of the COVID vaccine. And particularly interesting is Julia, is her name Jamin, is that correct?
Julie Jamin, yeah.
Julie Jamin, and she started out as a civil rights marcher, you know, working for women's safe spaces. She was anti-Vietnam, and she turns into this woman who's screaming at a transgender person in a restroom about whether they have a penis. I mean, it's just such an amazing transformation. Tell me what went into that.
I think, you know, in both cases, Judy Wilkes was a really interesting person. She was a nurse. She was a geriatric nurse. She spent many, many years working with elderly people. She had brought a lot of homeless people into her house over the years. She was in many ways a sort of, you know, very decent human being. But she went down this right-wing rabbit hole. She started watching and listening to more and more right-wing talk radio, talk television, getting more and more of her news from these sort of dark recesses of the internet, and gradually became more and more committed to a sort of conspiratorial worldview, especially around COVID and the belief that the COVID vaccine was, you know, illegitimate, that there was this big hoax that was being sort of foisted on the global community by big pharma, by government, and so on. And the more she went down this rabbit hole, the more it became a sort of political package. So you had a whole bunch of different issues that sort of all glommed together and allowed her to understand the world through this conspiratorial lens. I spent a lot of time talking with Jody Wilkes. She was very generous with her time and, you know, let me sort of arrange meetings with her fairly often. And I found her story really interesting, because had there been a slightly different set of scenario, had she been getting her information from slightly different places, someone like Jody Wilkes could probably have gone down a fairly left-wing path as well. And I think the same holds for Miss Jamin, Julie Jamin, who, you know, was an elderly woman who, as you said, had come out through the civil rights movement. She'd been very active in the anti-war movement in the 1960s and 70s. And by the 2020s, she sort of, I don't know if you can even call it turning rightward, but she'd gotten very involved in sort of the cultural war conflicts, especially around transgendered issues. And it had pushed her in a more rightward direction. And the trigger for her was she was in the local YMCA in a small town on the Olympic Peninsula. And she encountered a young transgendered adult and got very, very concerned because she thought there was a man in a woman's bathroom. And, you know, this issue has been a very powerful wedge issue in the culture wars now for several years. And so she got very upset about this. She then got kicked out of the YMCA for the way that she talked to this individual. Mm-hmm. And because she was kicked out of the YMCA, she then got sort of picked up by conservative media as a sort of martyr to the cause. And so Tucker Carlson interviewed her. A whole bunch of people on the sort of right of the media spectrum took up her story. And for a while, a couple of years back, this was sort of very hot news story. And it sort of went viral on the internet. And again, I thought, this was really interesting because had there been a slightly different set of events, a slightly different turn into how she got her information and so on, this is another individual who didn't need to go down that sort of right-wing route. And I was encountering this again and again when I was doing the reporting, that what had started as a sort of fairly healthy suspicion of big government, of the surveillance state and everything else, had morphed into something totally different. And a large part of that was to do with messaging and to do with where people were getting information and how the internet was impacting the way that they saw the world. And that, to me, was one of the stories that, you know, was really important in Chaos Comes Calling, because it spoke not just to these two small communities, but it speaks to a global problem, which is that in the last 5 to 10 years, technology has just changed so quickly, and the breakdown of traditional news sources has occurred so rapidly. And now you're seeing the expansion of artificial intelligence and the emergence of deep fake news that's almost impossible to tell from real news. And so you have this collapse in the idea of objectivity. You have this collapse in the idea that there is something true and there is something false, and there is a difference between the two. And everything becomes equally valid on the internet. If you say it loud enough, if you get enough clicks, if you get enough traction and it goes viral, that gives it intellectual credibility. Well, of course, it doesn't in reality, because there's still truth and there's still falsehood, there's still reality and there's still fantasy. But all of that gets conflated online. And I think what we saw in Squim, what we see in Shasta County, it's the story of our modern times, and how we deal with that is going to determine whether or not countries around the world can remain as functional, informed democracies.
One thing that you pick up on that I wonder if it's really gotten as much attention is between Republicans and conservatives themselves, where suddenly some people aren't Republican enough for other people under the same tent. Talk about one of the Republican residents who ended up pilloried as a rhino. Introduce us to one of them.
Well, there were a couple. In Shasta County, the entire Board of Supervisors at the beginning of the pandemic was controlled with sort of Reagan-era conservatives. And the two most high-profile of them were a woman called Mary Rickert, who was a local rancher, sort of quite a larger-than-life character. And she'd been involved in public service in Shasta County for decades. And her colleague, the chairman of the Board of Supervisors, was a man called Leonard Moti, who used to be the Reading police chief, again, had sort of pretty solid Republican credentials. But both Rickert and Moti were willing to go along with California's public health advice and restrictions in the early months of the pandemic. They weren't terribly happy about shutting down local restaurants and bars and so on, but they abided by the public health mandates. Now, for this sort of increasingly right-wing group that was coalescing in opposition to them, that was unforgivable. So they immediately were denounced as rhinos, which is this sort of slur on the right that stands for Republicans in name only. Mm. There was this sort of online trolling that took place against them. And eventually there was a recall campaign that was organized against both of them. Now, Mary Rickert narrowly survived the recall. Moti didn't. He was just trashed online. He suffered sort of personality assassination again and again and again. And he had all kinds of just vile, blood-curdling threats leveled his way. And he showed me these, and his wife showed me them. And I put some of them in the book, but they were really horrendous things that were being unleashed against him. So he was replaced by a hard right County Board of Supervisors member. And Shasta as a whole veered right. First, it went 3-2 with a hard right majority. But then after one more election cycle, it went 4-1. And the only moderate Republican left on that board was Mary Rickert. And Rickert would go to these meetings, and most of her colleagues, three of her colleagues, would basically shun her. And if they didn't shun her, they would issue sort of mockery toward her. And online, she started just getting, again, the most filthy, terrifying threats that would come her way on a daily basis. And this was politics in Shasta County. It was completely insane. And if you go online and you look at the Board of Supervisors meetings from that period, and they're still there on video recording, you can see just how uncouth and just how vicious these meetings had degenerated into. You know, what had happened there was just a stunning collapse, again, of political civility and decency.
I need to dodge down kind of an alley here because you bring this to mind. I interviewed a woman who wrote a book about QAnon recently, and I asked her what that had cost her personally, and I was really struck by the dismissive tone. Oh, I got death threats. You know, I got pictures of me with AI porn, and it was so matter of fact. It was so like just another day. This is what happens to an author or a journalist when you try to investigate this kind of thing. And it makes me wonder how accepted you were by the town and what you endured reporting this.
Well, it depended on who I was talking to. So some people just refused to talk to me, and other people did talk to me, even though it was clear that they didn't agree with me and I didn't agree with them. And they also, you know, I make no bones about who I'm writing for. I'm the Nation magazine's correspondent. Everyone can Google The Nation. There's no secret. It's a political magazine that comes out of the left.
Right.
So I didn't try and hide that. But I did say, look, I want to tell your story. I want to understand where you're coming from. And I want to understand these divisions and these sort of rancorous fissures that have been expanded in American politics. And some people did talk to me, and I appreciated that. You know, I didn't agree with them necessarily, but I appreciated their willingness to explain their worldview. And of course, others didn't. And, you know, that's par for the course. That happens to journalists all the time, that some people are willing to talk, some people aren't willing. In terms of personal threats, I think, you know, at this point, it unfortunately is par for the course that every so often a journalist, you know, from whatever side of the political spectrum or even a non-political one, is going to get hate mail and going to get threats and going to get intimidating calls or emails. You know, in a sense, it's part of the job description, unfortunately, these days. And again, I think Donald Trump has an awful lot of responsibility for that because he labeled the media the enemy of the people. And he used his massive political rallies to deliberately target not just media organizations, but individual journalists. And that's shameful. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of stuff of absolute authoritarianism. It's not what you expect in a democracy.
Well, and of course, now we have Elon Musk, who was wondering idly why no one had tried to assassinate Kamala Harris.
Yeah, I mean, Musk is a whole other conversation, but the way Musk has used and abused Twitter or X or whatever he's now calling it is, you know, an extraordinary story in and of itself, that the richest man on earth has bought up one of the most powerful communications tools on earth and is using it not to foster the public good, but to replatform extremists and racists and Nazis and fascists and people who for 2 years have been deplatformed by Twitter. And in the name of free speech is giving these vile racial rumors circulation. You saw this in England in August, where Twitter was the site of choice, where people went on after this horrendous killing of three young girls in Northern England. These rumor mongers went on and began spreading the rumor that it was undocumented Muslim immigrants. Well, it wasn't. That wasn't anything to do with that story. But within days, there were racial mobs outside asylum centers trying to burn those asylum centers down with people inside. And Musk did nothing to quell the flames. In fact, quite the reverse. Musk went online and tweeted that civil war is inevitable in England. Well, first of all, that was a fundamental misreading of where England is. England's nowhere near civil war. But second of all, it was just such an irresponsible thing to do for someone with Elon Musk's messaging clout and ability to reach millions of people. So I do think that's a separate story, but I think it's one that, you know, over time, governments are going to have to grapple with what to do with out-of-control social media platforms and what to do with out-of-control social media bosses.
You know, Donald Trump actually, you know, stirs the waters as well, of course. And the way it factors in here is Antifa, classic bugbear in the rhetoric of small conservative communities. And he's from the George Floyd protesters on. He was, well, this is Antifa. And he painted them as some sort of organized organization. And if you heard him talk, you would think that there was an Antifa office somewhere and elected officials and of course, it's nothing like that, but that's the kind of thing that plays out in small towns because he says it so convincingly, and that's where you get the rhetoric that leads to violence and leads to ruptures between residents.
That's right, and you know, one of the things I found so interesting when I was writing my book, there was this moment on the Olympic Peninsula when after the George Floyd killing, when there were these racial justice protests all over the country, and some of those protests had turned very, very violent. You know, there was rioting and there was burning of buildings, but most of them were peaceful. And certainly the ones on the Olympic Peninsula and these small towns were peaceful expressions of just civic outrage at what had happened to George Floyd. But these rumors started circulating and they spread so quickly and they were so hard to contain and to correct. These rumors started circulating that Antifa was on the way down to the peninsula and Black Lives Matter was on the way down to the peninsula to burn the towns down. And locals basically took up arms to defend their towns from this non-existent threat. And you had these series of extraordinarily dangerous flashpoint moments. One of them in the town of Squim, where you had armed men and women descending on a peaceful Black Lives Matter racial justice protest. And the other one in a little town called Fork, which is south of Squim on the peninsula. And in Fork, these rumors had spread that a white bus filled with rioters was about to descend on the peninsula. Well, a white bus did show up, but it wasn't filled with rioters. It was filled with a mixed race family that was going camping in the Olympic National Forest. Mm-hmm. And that family was chased by an armed group on all-terrain vehicles and surrounded. And it could easily have degenerated into a lynching. I mean, that was how scary it was. It didn't in the end. It was defused by the local sheriff's office eventually. But there was a period of half an hour to an hour where that family was entirely at the mercy of a mob. And that mob had been fired up by a series of rumors. And those rumors, in turn, had been given credence by the kind of rhetoric that was coming out of DC from Donald Trump about Antifa, about Black Lives Matter, and so on. So this stuff has consequences. And again, that's the point of my book, is to show that when you have a national discourse that gets as coarse and as violent as the national discourse that was unleashed by Donald Trump, it's not just an abstract problem. It's a very real on-the-ground problem in communities, and it impacts people's lives. And when you read Chaos Comes Calling, the stories in those books, in the book, the stories show just how impactful that rhetoric is and just how damaging it is to local community fabric.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a quick break here. That's Sasha Abramski. You're hearing the book is Chaos Comes Calling, The Battle Against the Far-Right Takeover of Small Town America. As always, we'd love to hear your contributions to this hour. Our phone number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Or you can email, we're watching our email, at yourcall@klw.org, yourcall@klw.org. We're going to take this brief break and come on back with more here on Your Call. This is Your Call. If you're just joining us, I'm Angie Cuero, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is our Friday Media Roundtable. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. If you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at yourcall@klw.org or call 866-798-TALK, 866-798-TALK, 8255, and that's the number you can call right now to participate in our conversation with Sasha Abramski as well. Sasha, I'm sure you're watching the developments in Shasta County, in Redding in particular, where the Board of Supervisors is very upset about a new law in California that says you can't come armed to an election place. Your Second Amendment, of course, exists, but it doesn't extend so far as to intimidating people outside a voting booth. And they're already saying that this is, you know, an abrogation of their Second Amendment rights. I wondered if you saw that in the making as you were putting your book together.
Absolutely, for a couple reasons, one of which is the hard right in Shasta County, which is militia-backed and some of the members of which are militia-influenced, has made the Second Amendment a sort of absolute litmus test. And their vision of the Second Amendment is literally no restrictions on gun ownership, no concealed carry laws, banning concealed carry, no banning of open carry, no banning of weapons in any facility. And, you know, this is such a sort of fundamentalist vision of the Second Amendment. But they went to the extent of trying to turn Shasta County into what they called a Second Amendment sanctuary county, where literally none of California's gun laws would be enforced by local law enforcement. The second thing is they invited a major election denier, a man called Douglas Frank, who's been sort of going around the country with his data that he claims shows that dead people are voting and there's massive systemic fraud and so on. And he's been challenged by so many different election specialists, but they invited him in to Board of Supervisors meetings to give his spiel about why the vote had been compromised in his view. So no, it doesn't surprise me at all, because the state is controlled, the county is controlled by election deniers. The county voted to end its contract with Dominion voting machines right before the election, which, you know, was both expensive and also a sort of cedar of chaos. And they're fundamentalists about guns. So the idea that they would want sort of armed individuals able to stroll in and out of election stations to quote unquote monitor the vote count, that doesn't surprise me in the least. But again, it's deeply disturbing, because when you introduce armed people into a vote count situation, inevitably it's intimidating, and inevitably it reduces the sort of flexibility of democracy. It makes the whole system that much more likely to fail.
I think it's worth going into just how many guns are out there. We all know that guns permeate American society. We all know that gun ownership is so important to so many people. But by 2023, more than a third of American adults owned at least one gun, and most of those individuals owned multiple weapons. There are over 400 million privately owned guns in the country. And since 2020, when the pandemic hit, racial justice protests across the country and the country's political divisions came to a head around the presidential election that Trump refused to concede. At that time, Americans purchased between 16 and 20 million new guns per year. Now, with the way this applies to what we were just talking about, the new rule in California about not bringing your gun to the voting booth, I want to be careful not to paint with too broad a brush. I'm sure that you encountered perfectly sane gun owners who don't see a role for a gun at a voting booth, who would come down on the opposite side of the equation. Is that true?
Yeah, look, I've interviewed people around the country on guns and on gun ownership over the years. I've met many gun owners who are perfectly reasonable individuals who have guns either for self-protection or for hunting or for sport. And then I've met other people who fetishize the possession of high-powered automatic weaponry that there's really no legitimate reason to have. You're not going to go hunting with an AK-47. Mm-hmm. You don't need to protect your house with an automatic weapon. These are killing machines. And when they're sold by gun stores, or when they're given constitutional protection by the Supreme Court, it's entirely predictable that bad things follow. You know, it's no mystery why America has mass shootings and no other Western democracy does. It's because no other Western democracy allows its citizens to buy high-powered weaponry on a whim. Mm-hmm. And this country not only allows people to, but in many ways encourages people to. Now, you know, that's dangerous just in terms of what it does to crime, what it does to violent crime, what it does to murder rates and so on. It's also really dangerous in terms of what it does to politics, because as you mentioned, what it means is people are turning up at demonstrations heavily armed. And, you know, most other countries, if you look at a political protest in England or in Australia or Japan or Canada or South Korea, wherever it might be, you may see 100,000 people on the streets, but you don't see 100,000 people on the streets, a significant portion of whom are carrying weapons. Mm-hmm. Whereas in America, that's the case. You now have this possibility that heavily armed groups are going to go onto the streets with constitutional blessing and protection. And we sort of saw an inkling of the damage this could do with January 6th, 2021, where Trump basically conjured up a mob into the heart of the nation's capital to break up the most important moment in the nation's democratic political process, the transfer of power. Now, that's an extraordinary development. And Trump's giving every indication that he'd be willing to do the same again. I'm not sure he'd be capable of doing the same again. But in terms of his instincts, he's saying to any reporter who asks him that, you know, I may accept the election result, but I may not. Right. I'll accept the election result if I win, but if I don't, it probably means there's voter fraud. Well, if you convince millions of armed followers that there's voter fraud, at least some of them are going to do something really, really ugly in response to that. I mean, that's, you know, it's a no-brainer that if you conjure up that much anger, that much fury, that much rage, some people will act on that. And Trump's playing with fire here in 2024, just like he played with fire in 2020 and early 2021.
Well, that brings us back to another list of statistics that really has bearing on this conversation. Through the 2010s and the 2020s, polls show that an increasing percentage of Americans believe political violence is justified. And by 2022, that number was well up over 30%. And among white voters, the number is near 40%. Another way we're seeing this manifest is people being trained on election monitoring from outside of urban areas. and coming from the suburbs into the urban areas to monitor the polls. And in some cases, some of them are armed as well. So you can see the powder keg. You have people who believe that guns belong at the polls. You have people who believe that political violence is justified. And you have people who believe that the elections are being manipulated. You put those three together, you've got a disaster.
Yeah, and I'd add into that just the general suspicion of any and every government institution and any and every area of expertise. And that was preceding the pandemic, but it was exacerbated by the pandemic and by these sort of right-wing organizing efforts against public health restrictions. So if you add in that sort of idea that big government is out to get you, that there's no sort of legitimacy in the expertise when electoral experts say, you know, systems are safe, that probably means they're not safe. You know, this sort of Alice in Wonderland world where everything is the exact opposite of what it seems to be. So when you have all of that, that creates all of the conditions for social chaos. And I think it's one reason that outside observers and foreign overseas governments are looking at the American political process, you know, with this sense of impending horror, this idea that what, you know, for two centuries was seen as being the sort of gold bar of a functioning democratic political system is really, you know, at its foundations now wobbling. And it's got people who are trying to make that wobble worse. It's got people like Donald Trump, and not just Donald Trump, but it's got these, you know, very influential political figures who are sowing so much doubt in the democratic process that millions of their followers have sort of walked away from an understanding of the importance of democracy. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, if you're an outsider looking in, that's a horrifying prospect, because America is so powerful and America's global footprint is so large. If America's faith in democracy is shredded, that has an impact not just in America, that has an impact globally.
Mm-hmm. You know, in fact, there's a moment in your book that's kind of a grim comic relief. And that was, as an echo of January 6th, there were conservatives in Shasta County and they marched on the Capitol to quote unquote liberate the board offices. Well, there was nobody there. I mean, it's kind of funny when you think of these people just marching in there resolutely to liberate something that didn't need liberating. But even at the heart of that is something frightening, because what if someone had been there? What if they had been occupied? What if there was a board meeting going on? I mean, it doesn't take much to play out in your mind how that could have worked.
Yeah, I mean, you've read my book very carefully, and I appreciate that. But that scene is very powerful to me. It was on the same day as the January 6th uprising or insurrection or whatever, you know, whatever it's being called. The same day that you had these far right people in Washington, D.C. trying to prevent a peaceful transfer of power, you had these people in Shasta County marching on the Board of Supervisors office being led by Patrick Jones, who was a newly elected hard right member of the board. He would go on to become the chairman of the board, and he was adamantly opposed to lockdown measures. And at the time, the Board of Supervisors was having its meetings on Zoom. And the Board of Supervisors' audiences were able to ask comments, but on Zoom instead of in person. So Jones goes down to that office. He theatrically unlocks it. He opens it all up and he lets everybody in. Now, of course, you can't hold a meeting when you don't have a quorum, you don't have all the other Board of Supervisors members there and everything else. But the intent was to show some sort of very populist version of people power. Mm-hmm. Now, it wasn't people power, because anyone who was concerned about the pandemic, anybody who was immunocompromised, anybody who had sort of reason to fear getting the disease, they weren't there. The only people who were turning up at those in-person meetings in the depth of the pandemic, when thousands of Americans a day were dying, were the anti-maskers and the anti-vaxxers and the anti-lockdown movement and so on and so forth. It was theatrical. It didn't result in violence. But you're right, there was this sort of very menacing undertone. And where it got most intimidating was with public health officers like Shasta County's Dr. Ramstrom. And Dr. Ramstrom was routinely getting death threats. And she was routinely faced with, you know, very angry, sometimes armed people outside her offices. Well, that shouldn't be happening. Mm-hmm. Doctors shouldn't be going to work every day. Election workers shouldn't be going to work every day fearing that they're at risk of violence because of a political disagreement with a part of their constituency.
Well, and you look too at, I mentioned QAnon earlier. If you want to talk about making people too difficult to reason with, the mayor was on the air mouthing QAnon words. And for those who are not familiar, you know, these are people who have conspiracy theories from as simple as the election was stolen, inaccurate, but simple, you know, all the way to, you know, Hillary Clinton is a lizard wearing a human face. It runs the gamut. But tie QAnon into this picture for us.
Well, so the QAnon mayor was in Squim in Washington. And basically what happened was a really quite right-wing mayor had been appointed. Squim has a system like many cities do, where you have an elected council and then the council chooses the mayor. So this very right-wing local businessman called William Armacost had gotten elected. He was a councillor and he became the mayor. And it wasn't because Squim was a particularly hard right place. It wasn't. It was actually a sort of fairly sleepy, generally quite liberal retirement community. But like in many other places, when it came to local elections, a lot of people didn't vote. And so, you know, there was sort of more apathy than anything else. But it gave the right wing an opening to take power locally. And they did. And Armacost, early in the pandemic, had attracted attention from local opponents because he'd been posting a lot of QAnon-affiliated posts on his Facebook and other social media pages. Mm-hmm. And then, during the pandemic, when there couldn't be in-person meetings with constituents, the city council began meeting with constituents in various other formats, including radio shows. So he goes on to a local radio show called Coffee with the Mayor, I think it was called. And he basically says words to the effect of QAnon is a truth movement. It's, you know, wrongfully being persecuted by law enforcement. It's not a terrorist group. It doesn't believe in anything irrational. Check it out. And he told his constituents to sort of check out QAnon. Well, the problem with that was QAnon was absolutely a, you know, conspiracist group. It absolutely was promoting extremely weird and sometimes violent interpretations of the world. And it absolutely believed, quote unquote, that a storm is coming. Mm-hmm. And it kept using this sort of, you know, really weird language. And that was percolating down into Squim politics. Well, the thing is, when you have that kind of level of conspiratorial thinking, where everything is a conspiracy, where every sort of thing that goes wrong or everything that changes and everything that sort of is a move away from old ways of doing things, you explain it through conspiracy, which is what QAnon does. Well, that doesn't leave you a rational entry point to have a sort of political debate, because that's an article of faith. It's not an article of politics. And I think that's how we should understand QAnon. It's sort of this extremely destructive religious cult. Mm-hmm. And when religious cults take political power, it's a pretty good, you know, bet that bad things follow. I mean, you look at the track record of cults when they seek political influence, it never ends happily.
Right, right. Well, as long as we're tying in groups here, that's QAnon. What about white nationalism? Are they playing a role in your book?
Yeah, I mean, not everybody I talked to by any stretch of the imagination was white nationalist, but, you know, there were certainly, these groups were making inroads. And I've done a lot of reporting around the country, not just for this book, but for Nation articles and for articles in other magazines. And one of the things you see is that in very disempowered, economically marginalized communities, hard right groups, oftentimes with a very sort of racialized understanding of the world, have been making huge inroads recently in terms of organizing the disaffected. And they've been going into these small communities, and in some cases they've been doing community organizing from a very right wing perspective. But they've been going in there, they've been sort of putting together, in some cases, you know, food distribution networks, they've been doing what they can to help local residents. And in exchange, sort of much like the Salvation Army will, you know, help the homeless, but you have to sort of go pray with them. In exchange, these nationalist groups expect the people they're helping to sort of start glomming onto their racialized ideology. And, you know, that's a really unpleasant scenario, because what it means is there's a sort of underbelly in American society at the moment at particular risk of right-wing racialized radicalization. Which is why law enforcement groups, you know, for the past several years have looked at what's happening and said some of these groups represent the single biggest domestic terror threat facing America, because a lot of these groups are explicitly violent. If you look at some of these neo-Nazi groupings, they want nothing more than to sow enough political chaos that the democratic, pluralist, multicultural, multiracial society breaks down, because they believe that into the void they can sort of insert this very hard right, white identitarian political community. And if they succeed, the country will look unrecognizable. So there is a lot at stake here in pushing back against these right-wing organizing efforts.
Well, and it's worth noting, too, that a lot of police groups and, to some extent, the military have been infiltrated by white nationalists. That's a problem,
that's right. Too. It is, and the Southern Poverty Law Center and various other groups have been monitoring this and tracking this. But, you know, there's definitely an awful lot of ex-military and maybe current military and police officers in the Oath Keepers, for example. And there's this constitutional sheriffs movement that basically says, well, a lot of the laws and restrictions we have, especially around gun ownership, are unconstitutional, and the constitutional sheriffs won't enforce them. There are a lot of law enforcement who were involved in January 6th, and a lot of ex-military involved in January 6th. And we know that from looking at who's been prosecuted after right. January 6th. A lot of military and ex-military were involved and are involved in the Oath Keepers. You know, these are groups that aren't sort of haphazard. They're groups that are very well organized and that have some military training behind them. And that's a bad situation. You never want a situation where armed, trained groups are infiltrated by extremists.
Well, and this is a time that you'd really want the media to step up. You really want this kind of thing to be common knowledge. You really want all of these various groups to be tracked. And you want Donald Trump to be portrayed as what he is. But, you know, we have what has now been termed sane washing, particularly on the part of the New York Times, essentially treating this as a normal election or, you know, the tit for tat, the he said, she said, as though one side isn't necessarily a threat to democracy itself. They're normalizing him. And I just wonder what this looks like through your eyes, having been doing the work you're doing.
Well, from my perspective, that's very, very dangerous. And even forgetting about the fact that Trump has sort of slid so far into, you know, far-right demagoguery, that even forgetting the fact that Trump, you know, gives a nod and a wink to QAnon whenever he's given a chance, you know, even forgetting the fact that Trump peddles and repeddles rumors like, you know, his nonsense that Haitians are eating cats and dogs in Springfield, you know, even forgetting all of the sort of right-wing bombast of the Trump campaign, this isn't ordinary for the following reason. It's not ordinary because one of the candidates was impeached twice, the second time for trying to incite an insurrection. It isn't normal because one of the candidates has been convicted on 34 felony counts and is facing dozens more at a state and federal level. It isn't normal because one of the candidates has been found liable for sexual abuse, fined millions of dollars for defamation, and his companies have been fined hundreds of millions of dollars for business and tax fraud. None of this is normal. So when you're talking about the New York Times or anyone else sane-washing it, it's not just that there's been this sort of inability as we've gotten closer to the election to really call out the political extremism at the heart of Trump's message, but it's also that there's been this inability to keep a focus on the fact that one candidate is felonious. Mm-hmm. Well, my goodness, you know, in what functioning democracy does somebody with that track record and that resume have a viable shot at reaching the White House? I mean, it really speaks volumes to, as you said, this sane washing of the Donald Trump candidacy.
Is this an element in why the election is, at least according to the polls, why this election is so close that the media is lagging in its job?
Well, I think it's a measure of how polarized the media is, and the fact that even when you have the liberal media, you know, making half-hearted efforts at the very least to hold Trump to account, you've got this whole other media ecosystem from Fox News rightward to the One America Network, InfoWars, Steve Bannon's show, and so on. You have all of these media messaging outlets that are pumping this sort of bilious messaging into ordinary Americans' homes. And there's been a collapse in how and where we get accurate information. You know, 10, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, most Americans would have still been reading and receiving newspapers. Today, that just isn't the case. Mm. So an increasing number of Americans are getting their primary news from X, from Instagram, from Twitter, from TikTok, from Facebook, and so on. Well, unfortunately, that's a lousy way of getting the news. It premiums disinformation. It's algorithm driven, which means that if you're already predisposed to sort of view the world through, let's say, a racial lens, you're going to get more and more stories justifying your racist ideas. It's predisposed to make you stay within your own echo chamber. Well, a democracy functions when you get outside your own box, when you are able to approach the news from a diversity of viewpoints, when you're able to get a diversity of viewpoints in what columns you read, in what articles you read, in what TV shows you watch, what radio shows you listen to. Well, that's disappearing. And the more that we're sort of compartmentalized into our own echo chambers, the less that we're able to reach across to other community members who may disagree with us. As I said, when I was writing my book, I talked to plenty of people I didn't agree with, but it was important to talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you literally refuse to talk to people you disagree with, you shrink your own world. And I think if you shrink your own world, it's in that kind of milieu that it becomes more understandable why someone like Donald Trump retains such a sort of stunningly high level of stable support, whether it's 40%, 42, 45, or maybe 47, whatever it may be. You know, in a normal environment, that would not be the case. He's got so much baggage at this point that he would not be a credible political candidate. And yet he is. And I think that's fascinating and disturbing in about equal measure.
Sasha Abramski, as anticipated, this was an excellent hour with you, and thank you so much.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Thanks again.
Absolutely. In this hour, we've been discussing Sasha Abramski's new book, Chaos Comes Calling, The Battle Against the Far-Right Takeover of Small Town America. If you've missed any part of today's show, if you want to check out Your Call's previous shows, or you want to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. Thank you very much. Email us with your questions, comments, and show suggestions. We're always open to hearing from you. Yourcall@kalw.org. Well, follow us on the aforementioned X, if you can swallow it, at Your Call Radio. Malihi Razazan produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Angie Cuero, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.